Welcome to Guerrilla Radio, recorded January 24th, 2024. Well, Monday, Canada's military aided in the bombing of Yemen. The Department of National Defense says Canada and a coalition of like-minded nations support the Anglo-American bombing of the country. The CIA World Factbook says suffers, quote, massive poverty, food insecurity, unemployment, and high inflation. Yemen is also one of the poorest places on the planet and has been victim to a long-running regime change campaign sponsored by the same Anglo-American Axis powers now bombing it, all factors making it a sterling candidate for Canadian political and military meddling. According to my first guest, Canada has contributed to the undermining and overthrowing of more than 20 separate national governments since the middle of the last century, all of them in countries that dared declare political and economic sovereignty. Eve Angler is a Montreal-based political activist and the author of 12 books, mostly detailing the dark dealings of Canada's foreign policy elite. Make that 13 titles as of next week when Berica Books releases Eve's latest, co-authored with Owen Schalk, Canada's Long Fight Against Democracy. Eve is also a prolific essayist whose writing appears across the internet and at his website, eveangler.com, where his most recent piece, When Leftists Use Anti-Semitism Smears to Weaken Palestinian Solidarity. Eve Angler in the first half. And on January 7th, Ecuadorian gang boss Adolfo Macias escaped from prison, embarrassing the recently elected tough-on-crime president Daniel Noboa. Since then, paramilitary raids and assassinations of public figures, one notably killed on live television, have ping-ponged, marking an escalation of violence that at first paralyzed and continues to terrorize the South American nation. Joe Emmonsberger is a Canadian-Ecuadorian engineer, journalist, and co-author with Justin Potter of the book Extraordinary Threat, the U.S. Empire, the Media, and 20 Years of Coup Attempts in Venezuela. Joe's many articles focusing on Western media coverage of the Americas can be found at fair.org, Counterpunch, and Telesur English, among other places. Joe Emmonsberger and the chaotic descent of Latin America's once most peaceful nation in the second half. But first, Eve Angler and Canada's regime change cowboys high in the saddle over Yemen. Welcome back to the show, Eve.
Thanks for having me.
Well, hey, and welcome back home. You recently returned from a stay in East Africa. Eve, did you get a sense while you were there of the public mood regarding the Gaza genocide and the actions, especially of Yemen's Ansar Allah, referred to in the media here, of course, as the Houthis?
Yeah, what I can say is that when the people, everyone I talk to, mostly with my partner's family, they obviously consider what Israel's doing as brutal and shocking, and I'm guessing that that is a pretty widely held opinion among Ugandans. I can also say that, but I didn't, you know, talk to many people on the street about it. But you can glean from reading the East African, which is a kind of like the Financial Times or Wall Street Journal of Uganda, Kenya, and Tanzania, that. You know, even in this fairly elite paper, the commentary was all very clearly that, you know, Israel's committing genocide. And by Canadian standards, you know, they're publishing articles that are, you know, unacceptable in the, you know, liberal Toronto Star or on the CBC website. So clearly among elite opinion in Uganda, it's, you know, They see it as it actually is, not how it's reframed in our propaganda system.
Well, and Eve, congratulations on your new book. Now, this is number 13, if I'm counting correctly. I've run out of fingers, so correct me if I'm wrong. Canada's Long Fight Against Democracy. When you talk about the acceptable views rebroadcast on the CBC about this issue or that issue, how much, Eve, is the media in this country responsible for this continued behavior of Canada, as you describe in your book, this fight against democracy?
The media is integral to the process. As I've made the point previously, you know, on international affairs, media's power is much greater than on domestic issues, because most people have, when it comes to like the healthcare system or minimum wage, most people have some, you know, they maybe they work minimum wage, they have family members working minimum wage. So increasing the minimum wage, they understand the effects. And even if the media says it's going to, you know, lead to the end of business, or, you know, if they say that the healthcare system is all a disaster and this and that, if you have some personal interaction with the health system, you know, okay, yeah, there are problems, but, you know, I didn't have to pay to use it. But when it comes to international affairs, we have almost no, most people have very little kind of like personal grounding. So how the media frames the issues becomes so politically important. And on foreign policy issues in general, the media is deeply aligned with the government perspective, with the perspective of power. And, you know, concretely with regards to the book about Canada's role in 20 different coups over the past 70 years, you know, you can say it's like permissible in the dominant media to say that, you know, Canada has supported undemocratic governments, right? Like we've, you know, sold weapons to the dictatorship in Saudi Arabia. That's like a sort of permissible. But to say that Canada has repeatedly not just upheld, you know, anti-democratic governments or worked with anti-democratic governments, but overthrown elected governments because they were, you know, working against the interests of the U.S. empire and the corporate world. That's just absolutely unpermissible because Canada is a force for democracy. It's just like taken for granted. We just, you know, we don't even need to have that discussion. It's obvious that Canada is a force for democracy, even if any serious look at the historic record shows that that's not the case. You know, the left end of the dominant media, the CBC or Toronto Star, they simply will not allow, maybe, you know, once every year they have one op-ed that says that Canada has overthrown elected governments. But they, as any sort of consistent theme on international affairs, it's just impermissible to say Canada has consistently undermined democracy. And that's, you know, way at the far liberal end of the officialdom media.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Guerrilla Radio. I'm speaking today with Yves Engler. Yves, a Montreal-based political activist, and he's an author of a dozen books. But wait, not a dozen, 13 books. As of the end of this month, Baraka Books will release a book that Yves co-authored with Owen Schock, if you could correct my pronunciation on that, Yves. It's called Canada's Long Fight Against Democracy. Yves, this isn't the first time that you've collaborated on a book. Can you tell me about your collaborator and firstly how to correctly pronounce his name, perhaps?
That's correct. And Owen is a young, impressive voice in challenging Canadian foreign policy. It's I don't know if people have seen, people could check out his writing on particularly on Canadian Dimension, but he has been the last couple of years published dozens and dozens of articles on a wide range of Canadian foreign policy topics that are really indispensable, and I think that I've said that I think that the fight around making for a just Canadian foreign policy, unfortunately, it's not going to happen overnight, and it's going to take decades and decades of struggle, mostly, but also at the ideological level of consciousness raising. And Owen has been a really important contributor to that, to breaking down the mythology in recent years. It was very nice process of collaborating with him to publish this. This history of Canada's role in foreign coups.
Of course, the Gaza thing, the Gaza genocide goes on. Eve, I had something here. You were talking on your program, and you can reiterate your Monday show for everybody, but I just came in kind of late and caught in the rerun. You were saying that you were blocked entrance into the United States recently. And if I get this right, you think that it might have something to do with your criticism of America's role in Gaza. Am I getting this right?
Well, the first part, yes. To go to Uganda, we were set to fly through New York, and we had a 20-hour layover where the plan was for our six-year-old son to go down to see, you know, Times Square, and a short little trip. But I was blocked at the U.S. Border agents who happened to have a piece of the Montreal airport. So I wasn't even allowed to get on the plane. I don't know why. The official reason for stopping me was something to do with in 2007. And in my understanding, I have to check out these details, but they're claiming that I was convicted of a crime in 2007, which would be obviously a political crime. I don't actually understand that to be true. Maybe my memory has gotten me self got I've been got so confused, but I'm pretty sure it's not correct. But I've been to the U.S. since 2007 multiple times. I have had difficulty one other time that I was ultimately let in 2010. But I've been probably seven or eight times, I think, over the past 15, 17 years. My guess for why they have targeted me was to do with the fact that we disrupted Secretary of State Blinken and Melanie Jolie about a year and a bit ago at the Jean Talon market. Very successful. They came out to a kind of public area and a handful of us yelled, mostly around Haiti, and they had to actually scuttle away very quickly. It was quite a successful, widely reported on. And also about a year and a half ago, the U.S. ambassador was trying to speak. I spoke here in Montreal, and I tried to enter the room, and I was going to, you know, say bad things about the U.S. empire, and I was detained and arrested for that. Ultimately, I agreed to this sort of condition to have the whole thing kind of gotten rid of, which, as I understood, was all dealt with. The condition has ended. And so it's possible it's just more general that I've, you know, been engaged politically a lot in the last couple of years, and that sort of got onto the U.S. government's radar. But my guess is it has to do with either the Secretary Blinken's visit to Montreal or the U.S. ambassador incident. And of course, that was quite unpleasant to be blocked from. I had to get a whole new ticket, and it was kind of a mess. But, you know, the U.S. empire, they struck back against my questioning of U.S. Canadian imperialism.
Well, it brings back the whole no-fly list era and stuff. And I guess that never really went away. People just stopped talking about it. Yeah, well, you and I have talked about your work with the Disruption Network. Do you want to briefly describe what Disruption Network is, especially in the context of all those that are coming out week in and week out? I know they've been doing it in Montreal. They've been doing it, or we've been doing it here in Victoria too. But every week since the first week after October 7th, people have been manifesting at the legislature in Victoria's case, but in Montreal too, in demonstrating against the ongoing Gaza genocide. People that are maybe fed up and thinking, well, geez, you know, it's great, we go out there and stand around, but what does it accomplish? Well, there's other tactics too, and Disruption Network is one of them. Do you want to describe what it is?
Yeah, well, so Disruption Network Canada, which was a sort of formalized alliance or information sharing network, kind of got squashed by the pandemic. We had kind of individuals across the country, you know, sharing information about upcoming meetings by ministers and going there and asking tough questions, or in some cases kind of more actively disrupting events. Now, that kind of political tactic, we've seen a whole lot of that, and quite successfully in recent months with the popular uprising against Canada's role in Israel's enabling Israel's genocide, the, probably the best example of that where there were people in Vancouver maybe 6 weeks, 2 months ago, where they figured out where Trudeau was at a restaurant, and they got very good. They got right next to Trudeau with very good video image of demanding he call for a ceasefire. And he was forced out of the restaurant, and then they followed up with another one at another restaurant that he, I guess, he moved to later on in the evening. And there's been you know, a whole bunch of those examples of it's kind of melding the sort of technology of the day, in that we all have access to camera, or most of us have access to cameras on our phones, and there's the social media, so you can ask tough questions of politicians, or interrupt a meeting, film it yourself, post it on X, on Facebook, on other social media, and often it gets very wide circulation of social media. Also, in the case of the Vancouver disruption I was talking about 2 months ago, that was, you know, I think that ended up being the top item on the CBC, the National. I saw it on the National. So it even gets picked up by the corporate media, by the dominant media. And I think there's for foreign policy issues, for issues where the media, there's just so little room for critical discussion, this type of tactic becomes very important, because it is a way, in some cases, it's a way, if you go to a press conference and you disrupt on a foreign policy issue, you can get the corporate media to report on it because they are there. And so you sort of take advantage of the power the government has, the ministers have, to convene the media, the dominant media. And then you just go there and you sort of steal a little bit of their thunder. You steal a little bit of the messaging by going and raising a different issue. Oftentimes, even when you do that, the corporate media won't even report on it. But that's where the social media side comes into it, where you can film yourself doing it, and you can have it circulated widely on social media. So it's complementary to mass protests, to the direct actions that have been taking place in terms of shutting down. I think people have all kinds of things, shutting down bridges and train lines and different meetings. But I think the tactic of often done at an individual level, or two or three people, just going to these meetings, press conferences, events, and either just doing it in a questioning format, which often can be in fact, the most successful, because these what you find is that these ministers don't ever get asked. The journalists in the officialdom that go to their that have access to these politicians, they never ask the really simple questions that you say that Russian and Belarusian athletes should be banned from international sporting competitions like the Olympics. But do you feel the same way about U.S. troops or U.S. athletes after the U.S. invasion? That's one of the ones I asked Canada's sports minister, and she literally looked at me and sort of scoffed, like this was the craziest question in the world, even though it was actually a totally reasonable question. But they never get asked these questions. And so you can do that kind of at an individual level and really kind of embarrass them. And sometimes, like millions of people watch these things on social media and, very small pushback to the stifling discourse in the dominant media.
Well, yeah. Well, we've seen with disruption, Code Pink has done it in the States with great effect. And Tamara Lawrence of Canadian Voice of Women for Peace here in Canada has done a number of these interventions as well. Well, and the government was in your neck of the woods just yesterday in Montreal taking a retreat. I guess they had spa treatment and stuff as well at this swanky hotel downtown. And they were welcome there as well, I understand. Were you there?
Yeah, I was there, and I can tell you this was the fortress Queen Elizabeth. The policing around the hotel was absolutely stunning. I went down after dropping my son off to school at 8 a.m. I went down immediately to the hotel, and I was kind of just it's all connected into the Montreal train station, and it's connected into a mall. And I was hanging out at the mall, kind of hoping that I might, you know, Christopher Friedland might go get a coffee, or, you know, some Trudeau might go wandering about. And I was literally just sitting in this cafe area, not in the hotel, but close to the hotel, not in it. And I had these two undercovers just sit and watch me for probably 30 minutes. And I finally went up to them. I went up to him and asked him if he was an RCMP agent. I think in hindsight, he probably wasn't RCMP. I think he was actually Montreal police. But it was just a stunning level of police overreach. And obviously they would claim it was about, you know, stopping some sort of, like, I don't know, terrorist attack or whatnot. But they know full well that my danger is putting a video camera in the face of the prime minister or foreign minister and asking a tough question.
How did they ID you? Were you carrying a placard or something?
I wasn't carrying a placard, but they all recognized me. Unfortunately, at this point, they all recognized me. I literally, when I arrived around the side of the hotel, this Montreal police officer, as I walked around the corner, I saw him speaking. I, you know, heard him speaking to his microphone. Il est ici. He's here. They literally had we had two protests in front of the hotel, and when I went wandering around to the other side, Montreal police officers on bikes literally followed me. Biked over, and then when I went back to the other side, they biked over the other side. And the first time they did it, I saw them, and they saw me. I just started laughing, and they started laughing because I think they even think it's kind of a joke. But they're, you know, when you send hundreds of cops to a hotel, and there's nothing to do, that's what they do, is they just basically intimidate people who they know full well that at worst are going to maybe, you know, yell at the politician. I've seen this before. Obviously, we saw that the G20 protests in Toronto. Mm-hmm. I saw some of that. I've seen it at other kind of things. It's part of this the law. I think the logic of policing is that I had this whole discussion with the police officer. And he was like, "Well, it just because, you know, if I'm following you, it's no big deal. I had to be here anyways," because I was saying, "Well, this is a, you know, huge waste of resources to be following me like this." And he's like, "Well, I had to be here anyways." And I was like, "No, you don't. You know, you don't have to be here. That's a political decision. We're deciding to spend a lot of money on sending hundreds of police officers around this hotel rather than putting those resources into, I don't know, a, you know, school lunch program, right? These are political decisions, and an unfortunate, you know, there's lots of freedom in our society in different ways, but there is also a quite remarkably repressive element. And actually, just you know, one of the things I did do at the kind of milled about the outside the hotel in the mall that's connected to the hotel, and I had the opportunity to bump into David Cochrane, the CBC Power and Politics host. And I started asking him about why, you know, he has a double standards on his treatment with regards to Israel's, you know, they always say Hamas's massacre on October 7th, but they never use the same language around what the genocide Israel's committing. And this reporter, journalist, how he got away from it was to walk back into the fortress liberal cabinet retreat, and literally police physically blocked me from continuing to ask him questions. This is the antithesis of what a functioning democratic structure should be. Obviously, you should be able to ask journalists questions, or for that matter, politicians. But this is where the logic of security goes in the current, you know, state of things.
God, that reminds me of meeting Sasha Petrovich years ago at a college media conference in the elevator and saying and asking him about the recent, what was then recent, was the interception of Terry something Chuck, I've forgotten his name now. They had intercepted his emails between protesters in Vancouver at the Asia Pacific meetings, you know, APEC, way back when. And I asked him, well, did he think that, that they should be doing that? And he says, oh, it serves him right for, you know, talking on his email. This was a reporter saying that it was okay for one of his colleagues to have his messages between he and his sources intercepted. And he was taken to the carpet by the CBC for his comments with these protesters. Anyway, I don't know if you remember the case back in 2000-ish. 2001.
I don't, but what I think is the troubling element is that the level of like trust and close relations between media officials and both government officials and intelligence agencies. That's I think the and in this case of this Cochrane and how he, you know, I wasn't allowed into this hotel. He was allowed in. He had the special badge that got to the other side of the police line. I thought that was illustrative of how the official journalists and the official politician power structure are, you know, they're sort of they have equal rights. They're you know, part of the same team that gets you know, protected by the police.
Big media is what the, yeah. What they call it. Well, we're fast out of time, or actually we're over time. Eve, I really appreciate you taking the time. I know you're doing other interviews. Again, you know, the book is Canada's long fight against democracy, and there's myriad ways, sanctions, financing opposition parties, using the Canadian embassy in countries as hideouts for people that are coosters that are going to violently overthrow a government as they did in Ukraine. Secret cabals and military interventions. How, Eve, do people get their hands on Canada's long fight against democracy? Your book with Owen Schalk.
You can pre-order it through Baraka Books, and that's the best way. I think eventually it will hopefully be, and this is always really helpful from a personal standpoint. As many public libraries that can order it, you know, the best from a personal standpoint and political standpoint for that matter. So anyone out there listening, please order it via your public libraries, because it's both gets it out to more people, and also there's a whole payment structure for authors that is based partly on how many libraries have the book. But yeah, you can order it from barakabooks.com. Obviously, you can also order it through other, you know, corporate book purchasing places. But the best way is via Baraka Books. And also, I hope to I will be out on a tour probably later in March.
Yeah, well, we'll see you out here, hopefully, in Victoria. And again, it's barakabooks.com. Support Canadian publishing imprints, and talk to your librarian and say, hey, do you have that book by that great Canadian author? What was his name? Eve Angler? And say, why not? And get him to order books in. I know our department here is tired of listening to me already at my local library. But thanks a lot again for coming on the show, Eve.
Thanks for having me.
And I want everyone else to stay tuned, because I'm going to be talking with Joe Emmonsberger about what's going on in his familial native Ecuador. It's a mess down there right now from the most what was once lauded as the most peaceful country in Central America, now to open civic warfare going on between gangs and the police and the corruption, everything else. Stay tuned for that. Thanks again, Eve.
Thanks.
Are you listening?
We've seen the world shrink, and now you can hear it too. Guerrilla Radio, a new century of news every week at guerrilla-radio.com.
Congress and the Bundestag, you'll see them wring their hands and say how they wish in hindsight they had tried to understand, how they wish they'd seen the warning signs and heard the generals speak and believed them when they talked about the vengeance they would wreak. How they should have known this was not idle conversation, how they should have listened harder when they said elimination. Yes, once it's all too late and the graveyard